Teresa's got hers. She's excited. Okay, well, I was gone last week, and it's my understanding that Tad covered the question of mutual edification, mutual ministry. We have just a bunch of loose ends to tie up, and I think that it'd probably be best if we tie those things up before we move on. You know, as we continue to study on the assembly, we've kind of jumped around because so much is sort of tied together, and you can't really separate some things. So we've got some loose ends on when, some loose ends on who, and I hope that by the end of class we'll be able to finally start talking about what, and get into really what will be the rest of the class. But just so you know where we're headed, in talking about the question of when is the assembly, I'll give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about classes if there's any additional questions or comments, and then we need to address this question of should we meet more than just at the service when the communion is offered. Then we're going to slide over and finish up a few things on who. We'll talk about attendance. We'll talk about if the assembly is for non-Christians, and then we'll finish up on participation. We've talked about two of the three major components of participation, and that is the idea of mutual edification and the role of women in the assembly. There is one other question that we'll need to address, and if we get all that covered, then we'll start talking about what. So that kind of gives you an idea where we're headed. So let's go back to this question of what is the assembly. 2 weeks ago, we had essentially finished up talking about classes. The real question that we were trying to address is, are classes part of the assembly or not? And, outside of our class, Emily and I have been doing a lot of talking about this particular question. And just to sort of clarify how I see it, and I know that not everyone sees it this way, classes can be part of the assembly, but don't necessarily have to be part of the assembly. And I think it's all about how it's organized. If it's very clear that it's not part of the assembly, that all of the church or the majority of the church is not assembled together, then I would not view that as the assembly. That particular class would be more of a private Bible study. If we were to take the assembly and divide it into three or four or even two big divisions, then that would not be the assembly anymore because the whole church is not gathered together. How we, in our situation where a few members leave, it just is a gray area in my mind, I really think that it has all of the feel of the assembly. By and large, it looks like the assembly, and so I would think that it probably is the assembly, probably because of how we handle it. The Bible is just not very clear on it, and that's why we have such discussion about it, such disagreement. I didn't really allow for a lot of questions on classes. I know it's sort of 2 weeks old and you may have moved on, but were there any other comments or questions about the idea of classes in the assembly?
As we talk about this and thinking about it, many of us have been in education, have to go to seminars and things. You've been to seminars. Well, if you went to a seminar, of course, a lot of times they break up into groups. Well, if somebody asked you, well, were you assembled with the group that met down in Florida for such and such a meeting? Well, what would you say? Well, no, we split up, so I really wasn't. But, you wouldn't even discuss that. You'd just say, oh, yeah, I was with the, yeah. Was with the assembly. Somehow I get to thinking that we're trying to split hairs on this because we're trying to prove another point.
That's right.
I think they're trying to say, well, now, this issue with the women thing, I think, has a big bearing on trying to make a split hairs on this thing about this.
Yeah, and I think, what was it, 3 or 4 weeks ago, when we first introduced this, when I first introduced this discussion about classes, that is the issue. The two underlying issues, the reason why this is even a discussion, is if anything other than the service, portion of the service where communion is offered is the assembly, then if you don't attend, then you have this issue that we'll talk about today about attendance in Hebrews 10, 24, and 25, about not forsaking the assembly. Well, if all those other things are the assembly, you only come to one of the assemblies, well, you kind of have a problem, don't you? And then the second underlying issue is, what do we do about these passages that talk about women's role in the assembly? Those are the reasons, and that's why we even talk about classes now, because if you remember on the outline that we had given you, we weren't even going to talk about classes till the very end, but we can't really address this issue of who can participate until we address women's role in the church, and then that sort of leads us into this discussion of classes. They're all tied together, and you know, if you come to a conclusion on one, it by implication leads to conclusions on the others, and this is one of those things that has caused division in the church, and I just don't know why it caused division in the church. You know, I can view this time period now as the assembly, and Emily and I can have conversations, and we can come to a decision that, you know, if we're going to be what some will look at as a very hard line on it, that this is the assembly and therefore women should not speak. Emily and I can, as a family, come to that decision and put application, and it doesn't necessarily impact everyone else's decision on that. Do you see what I'm saying? That we don't have to make this a divisive issue. It can be an issue that we have some variations on, and still meet together. Maybe I'm not being real clear on that, but. Are there other comments, questions on this issue? I didn't really intend to spend a lot of time on it because I figured it was a couple of weeks old. Well, let's look at this next question about should we meet at times other than the first day of the week? Really, the question here is, should we meet more frequently than once per week to partake of the Lord's table? We know that communion is commanded for us to partake of on the first day of the week. Therefore, we can make some implications that tell us we need to at least assemble once per week to partake of the Lord's table. So the question then becomes, should we meet more than that? What do you think? I mean, clearly, as a group, we think the answer is yes, because we do have an assembly in Sunday evening and Wednesday evening. What passages come to your mind when you think about, well, should we meet more than just on Sunday mornings or on Sundays to partake of the Lord's table?
Well, Acts, the second chapter, you get the feeling that they met a lot.
Yeah, a lot. Like, how frequently did the first century church meet? Or at least the church in Jerusalem right after it was started. Let's go to Acts chapter 2. Bob, it sounds like you're there. Why don't you read 46 and 47?
So continuing daily with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. The Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved.
All right, very interesting here. The first church, the church that was established in Jerusalem right after that, they were meeting daily. Now, we might get the idea from reading this that where it says they were breaking bread from house to house, we might get the idea that they were taking communion. I don't know that, and when we look at other passages, I don't know that we're to understand that to mean communion, that they were sharing everything. We know that that's what they did. We also know that there are things that were different, right? When the church first started, they took up a collection routinely, didn't they? They had everything in common. People came and laid their goods at the apostles' feet, and everything was distributed. Now, by the time we get to Acts chapter, or 1 Corinthians chapter 16, collections are commanded to be taken not daily, but once a week on the first day of the week. So we know there are some things that happened in the first century, in the first starting of the church that didn't carry on. And so this idea of meeting daily, one could argue that, well, they did this because the church was in its infancy, therefore it's not required now. I would probably say that's true, but I think there's some other verses that we ought to consider, too, in answering this question of should we meet more than once a week. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 3. Let's look at verses 12 and 13 here. Hebrews chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. Someone read that for us.
Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin.
All right. These are about the only two passages that I can find that give us the idea that the church should meet more frequently than at the assembly. Well, there's a third passage, and we read it already. When Paul meets in the schoolhouse, he teaches daily, and I think the idea is that the church was assembling there daily. All of this leads us to this idea that we ought to meet frequently. We ought to meet as much as is necessary. Certainly, if a congregation is new, you know, when you first learn something, you just want to absorb it like a sponge, don't you? We get the idea that that's what's happening here. Here are these new Christians, and they just want to gobble it up. And so they want to meet every day. I think we sometimes can get sort of in a rut in thinking, well, we're going to meet three times a week, when, you know, the church was meeting daily in some cases. So in answering this question, should we meet more frequently than once per week? The answer is, well, we certainly can. Is it required? I don't see that it's required. If a congregation, based on its membership, based on the leadership at that congregation, felt that it would be acceptable to meet only for the service where they would partake of the Lord's table on Sunday, then I think they could be within their scriptural right to do that. Now, it might not be the best thing to do. There may be some, well, frankly, the congregations that do this are the congregations that need to meet more frequently. A lot of times we see weak congregations do this, congregations who are dwindling in numbers, congregations who their membership just isn't participating the way that it should, and therefore, because they just can't get the participation, they opt to discontinue all other services other than the first, the service with communion, which is entirely the wrong reason. The church met frequently because people needed it, not because they didn't need it. And so the idea that, well, our congregation is dwindling, therefore let's not meet very frequently, is sort of counterintuitive to what we see in the Bible. Any comments or questions on this particular question? We're going to be all over the map today, so I apologize in advance for that. But
did you have any comments on that back in chapter 2 of Acts?
Yeah.
In verse 42, when it says, they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, in the breaking of bread and prayers, and their fear came upon every soul. That breaking of bread there, is that a difference than the breaking bread in verse 46?
Well, I don't think there's any difference there. I think they're both talking about the same thing, and I have not... We're going to talk about this probably in more detail when we talk about communion. But my understanding of what is being discussed here, the idea of breaking of bread is of having a meal together, and wouldn't be breaking of bread like we see in 1 Corinthians 11, where it talks about communion. I have not looked a bunch into it. My
But you're going to talk about it later.
Yeah, I think because you're bringing it up, we will, for sure. It was one of those things that sort of, do we have time to talk about it? But we certainly will. I think it's talking about having a meal together, that they had everything in common. Here's all of these people who are from out of town, and they've got nothing because they were just planning on staying a couple of days, and here they've stayed over. They don't have the resources to take care of themselves, so they were all sharing, and that would mean sharing food.
Well, I talked to an individual one time who had the idea that every time you came together, you need to take the Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
Because I think his reasoning was because of this.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we will certainly address it then. I think we need to look at what that term breaking bread means and see how it's used. And I'll dig into that some more. Okay, other questions on this? I think that pretty much ends our discussion about when is the assembly. Let's finish up, kind of pick up these loose ends on who. Let's go in my notes to page 27. Well, why I was saying that, it's on my little card here. We're so scattered that my notes are organized, but we're not organized today, so I made a separate sheet to say what page I should turn to. Okay, in talking about who and the assembly, the first question that I think is really important for us to address is the issue of attendance. Is assembling even necessary? Kind of a funny question to ask, right? But have you ever come across a person who says they're a Christian, but they don't go to church? You ever run into that? I can't even tell you how many people I know who say that. Oh, I'm a Christian. Well, where do you go to church? Oh, I don't go to church. Oh, okay. All right. I mean, it's sort of interesting, but you know people that are that way. I know people that are that way. And it sort of begs the question of, is that even possible? Is it even possible to claim to be a Christian and then not assemble? Well, when we talk about attendance, what's the first verse that comes to mind? I've already mentioned it once, but what is it? Yeah, Hebrews chapter 10, verses 24 and 25, where it says, "And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, as so much the more as you see the day approaching." Oftentimes we sort of pluck out this phrase in verse 25 that says, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. But in context, what is the issue? Why is it that we're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together? Well, what is it that we do when we assemble? Or at least what does Hebrews chapter 10 tell us that we're supposed to do?
Exhorting,
stirring up one another with love. And so this idea, we're supposed to assemble together because there's something good that comes out of us assembling. But those that take this position that says, well, I'm a Christian, but I don't go to church, what are some of the objections that you hear? Why is it that they justify not going to church? What is it that you hear people say? I don't go to church.
I've heard people say, well, people there know better than me, or they're hypocrites.
Okay.
Why should I?
Okay. What else?
I have a personal savior. It's just between me and him.
Okay, Eddie.
I've heard the term "God's everywhere. He's under the stars." You know, I can worship wherever I please.
Okay, that's good. Other thoughts? Any other that you've heard? I had two that I thought we'd address. One's definitely related to Eddie's. Maybe Eddie's comment, and then Bob, the other one, I kind of will dread. Mike's is an interesting problem. I hadn't studied on it, but now that Mike said it, I've heard that too. Well, you know, church is just a bunch of hypocrites. Well, shame on us, right? I mean, we should not be putting a stumbling block in front of other people. And so we ought to be living our lives absolutely Christ-like as possible, so that we aren't the person who provides that stumbling block for someone else.
I've also heard people say, "Well, I'm not perfect." Or in other words, they had the view of only perfect people went to church, which is absolutely opposite of the way it ought to be. We come to church because we're not perfect.
Yeah.
So you know, that's pretty invalid excuse, but there are a few people that view that as you know, people who are close, very close to God, and if you don't get close to God first, then you can't come to church. Is
yeah.
the way they look at it, and they miss the whole point of you can't yeah. come to God unless you do it.
Yeah, people also use that as church. As an excuse for reasons to not get baptized. Well, I got to make my life right before I get baptized. No, getting baptized makes your life right, and then you get some help. Okay, Bob's comment was about, well, I've got a personal Savior, and the idea, the way I phrase that is, well, church doesn't save you, right? Some people will say, oh, going to church, that doesn't save you. And you know what? There's some truth in that, isn't it? It is a true statement. Does coming and meeting with Christians save you? No, it certainly does not. We know that Jesus is the one that saves us through His sacrifice on the cross. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 9, we're told, "For God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ." We obtain salvation through Jesus. There is no doubt that just coming to the assembly is not a means by which to be saved. Just because you come in the door doesn't mean that you're headed through the doors, the gates in heaven. It doesn't work that way. We know that I didn't write any of these passages down. We can look in the scriptures, particularly in the book of Revelation, where there's the letters to the churches of Asia, that there are some people that are doing things that are extremely wicked. Now, we're not told that they're not saved. We don't know. We can look at their practices and think from other scriptures that they're probably not saved, but yet they were assembling with Christians. So we know that there are those that are amongst us who just aren't going to be saved. Coming to church, coming to the assembly does not save you. Salvation comes through Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. The church is made up, though. The assembly is made up of the saved. We know that the church can be the agent of salvation by teaching people about what is needed to be saved. But the church itself does not save people. I think it's sort of a fine line to walk, because then you get to this next question of, well, can a person be saved outside of the church? Well, what's the answer to that question?
No,
but maybe with a little asterisk, right? Because are there people who are saved outside of the church?
Could be.
Yeah? Well, give me an example. Give me the easy example. Okay. Probably the answer is yes. That's before the church was started. I'm thinking about today.
I didn't hear what she said.
The thief on the cross.
He wasn't in the church.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, at the time when he was baptized, he wasn't. We don't know what happened to him. I mean,
he could have joined forces later on, but I'm saying at the time, he wasn't.
Yeah. We're making it way too complicated. No, we're still making it way too complicated.
The Lord adds to the church, right?
Okay.
Let's say someone's out there in the country somewhere and wants to be baptized.
Yeah, maybe I'm just making it too simple. Okay, all right, there we go. I think that we know that children are innocent. So when children die, I mean, I don't know if there's anyone who thinks that children are condemned to hell. I mean, I suppose there are some religious groups that baptize infants that think that infants, when they die, will go to hell. But, you know, a child who dies, they're not part of the church yet. Yet I think we understand that they're saved. Now, all of these other things, these are great questions, and we're just not going to address them because it's sort of outside the realm of the class. But I did want to point out that the church doesn't save us. And there are circumstances, or at least I think there probably are circumstances, exceptions, where, for example, children who die, who are in a state of innocence and do not understand the difference between right and wrong, and therefore are probably saved and yet not members of the church, or not part of the church. And so Everything else is sort of these gray questions that I just don't want to address. But this argument that, well, I don't need to go to church to be saved, well, there's some truth in it, right? Just like when Satan tempted Adam and Eve, there was a little bit of truth there, but he twisted it just enough to make it a lie. And so saying, using this as an excuse to not attend is just that same thing. It's taking a little bit of truth and twisting it. Eddie's comment was that I don't need to go to church to worship God, right? I can worship God everywhere because He's everywhere. And this too is also a true statement. You don't need to go to church, come and assemble to worship God. Jesus Himself, remember what He tells the woman at the well? That you don't need to work. There's no particular place that you need to go to worship God. John chapter 4, beginning in verse 20. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. Jesus said to her, basically she's saying, so where am I supposed to worship? Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship, we know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship Him. Jesus is clearly teaching that worship would no longer be confined to a place, right? That's what the old law was about, that you had to come to the temple to worship God. That was the whole reason why the golden calves were set up in Bethel and Dan, because the kingdom of Israel didn't want people traveling into the kingdom of Judah to worship. Well, you just worship these calves in these two locations I've set up. So the idea in the old covenant was you had to come to a place to worship. But Jesus says that's going to be done away with. There's nothing, we talked about this, there's nothing holy, there's nothing sacred about our building. It's just a building. There's what's holy and sacred is us. And so we can worship anywhere and at any time. And so in a sense, all of our life is worship. These objections both assume that the purpose of this objection assumes that the purpose of our assembling is to worship. And that certainly isn't the case. Remember what we talked about this in the very, I think it was the second class, the purposes of our assembly. The first purpose of our assembly is what? Or what's one of them? Why do we get together? That's right, to exhort, to encourage. Hebrews, the 10th chapter, we just talked about that. Isn't it interesting that in that passage is the one that we're talking about with this issue of attendance? Can this happen outside of the assembly? Well, yes, probably it can happen. But the passage that we look at that tells us we should assemble to exhort and encourage tells us not to forsake the assembly. The idea being is that assembling together is a reason, or encouraging and exhorting should happen when we assemble. What's another reason why we assemble? What was the purpose of our assembly?
Communion service.
All right, to partake of, to remember the death of Jesus. Acts chapter 20, 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Can this be accomplished outside of the assembly? Absolutely not. The idea, we call it communion. Well, can you commune with yourself? No. Communion is about working together, being in union with other people. So this idea that being able to remember the death of Jesus on your own, well, that's just something foreign. Edification is another thing that we said was the purpose of the assembly. Can this happen outside the assembly? Absolutely it can. And remember when we talked about worship, there weren't any scriptures that specifically tell us that when we assemble, we are to worship. But the idea is that our whole life should be one of worship. And so our assembly has other purposes, and worship is maybe more of a byproduct. All of these excuses as to why we don't need to meet together. Well, the church doesn't save me, or I've got a personal relationship, or all of these sort of miss the point. And it's all about our attitude. If Duane was here, he'd say it's about the heart, because it really is. Let's look at Psalm 122 and 1. Now, I understand this is about the Old Testament, but this is the attitude that we ought to have about assembling with other Christians. 122 and 1, if someone would read that for us.
I was glad when they said to me, let us go into the house of the Lord.
All right. This is the attitude that we ought to have. Oh, it's such a big deal that I got to go to the house of the Lord. Oh, it's such a drag that we're assembling together. No. The attitude that we ought to have is, I was glad. You were excited. It was the most exciting thing that you could do that week. I was glad when they said, let us go up to the house of the Lord. When it's time to assemble, this is the attitude that we ought to have. Any other comments or questions on attendance? Mike?
Would ask a question. Has anybody ever seen, you know, someone who said, well, I don't have to attend to serve the Lord. I don't have to meet with the saints. I don't have to do this and that, claims to be a Christian. Have you ever seen the person that claims that? Have you ever seen that? Are they a person that edifies other people? Are they a person that goes out and does good works for other people? Are they a person that is has strong moral character themselves? Or are they a person, are they just the opposite? Are they just, you know, I've never seen someone claims all that and yet fulfills all the other attributes of being a Christian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's usually that way that failing to assemble is not, it's the symptom and not the underlying problem. And usually there's a whole lot of other things going on that the reasons why people aren't assembling is just an excuse.
If you do all those other things, why wouldn't you want to?
Yeah,
that's like you, that you love.
Yeah, there was this is obviously not original. You've probably heard it before, but the idea of if you've got a big fire going and you pull one ember out, what happens to that one ember? It eventually goes out, doesn't it? Why? Because collectively, it's big. You know, the sum of the parts is greater than the whole, or I don't know how that works anyway. But the idea is that if you're not meeting with other Christians and you're just on your own, well, how can you be encouraged? You'd be pretty discouraged. How could you be edified? I mean, can it happen? Sure, it can happen. But what does the Ethiopian eunuch say? He's reading the scriptures and he says, "I don't understand this." And Philip then teaches him provides some teaching. Certainly, is it possible for you to read the scriptures and come to an understanding? Yes. But what do you do in the circumstance when you've come across something you don't understand? Well, then you're going to be left without much help, aren't you? All right, let's go to this last question that we'll address today, and that is the assembly for non-Christians? Wow, this is such a weird question, but this was one that was certainly on our list. And the answer is not exactly, right? When we assemble together, the assembly is for the assembly, right? The word church and assembly are essentially synonymous in the scriptures. So assembling together, the idea is that it's Christians assembling together. But so in answering the question directly, is the assembly for non-Christians? The answer is no, because non-Christians can't be part of the assembly, because the assembly is Christians. But really, the question being asked here is that, is this a closed session? Okay, you know, there's some, if you've ever been on a board before, the board will go into executive session, which basically means they kick everybody out who's not on the board. Can the church do something like that? Well, no, that's not how the church functions. And we know that's not how the first century church functioned either. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 14. And so this is the idea that we know that at least in the first century there were non-Christians, or the expectation would be that there would be non-Christians coming to the assembly of Christians. In 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 23, this is talking about how spiritual gifts are supposed to be used, but it's interesting how this passage reads. Therefore, if the whole church comes together in one place and all speak with tongues, and there come in those who are uninformed or unbelievers, will they not say that you are out of your mind? So here's this. We won't go into the details of what's being talked about here, but notice what it says. And there come in those who are uninformed. Well, is it possible that a person who's uninformed could be a Christian? Yes, but then it says an unbeliever, which we know that certainly is a non-Christian. So Paul at least makes the case that there's going to be circumstances when there's non-believers in the assembly. Now let's go to James chapter 2. And I just don't know what to do with this passage, because it's possible that these are non-Christians. It's also possible that these visitors are Christians. But I think it's important for us to look at. In James chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, "My brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. For if there should come into your assembly a man with gold rings and fine apparel, and there should also come in a poor man in filthy clothes, and you pay attention to the one wearing fine clothes, and say to him, 'Sit here in a good place,' and say to your poor man, 'You stand there,' or 'Sit here at my footstool,' have you not shown partiality amongst yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts?" Of course, the message that's being taught here in this passage is for us not to be respecters of persons, right? Just because somebody's dressed nicely should mean nothing. Their soul is no more valuable than the person who's dressed in filthy clothes. So we shouldn't be showing partiality. God doesn't show partiality in that respect. But this is an interesting question here. Who is being talked about here? Is this other Christians who you don't know? Are these Christians who you know? Are these non-Christians who you don't know? I don't know the answer to that. The passage isn't designed... That's not what James is talking about, so he doesn't go into those details. But you could make the argument that says here, well, you don't know who these people are, they're therefore not Christians. I think that's probably a stretch. What we do know for sure is that we don't have closed assemblies. It's not like their deacons are responsible to check your membership badge at the door. It doesn't work that way. The church's assemblies are open to all, because we know that edification is to happen here. And it's entirely possible that through a non-member's attendance that they could become a believer.
We might clarify that. You know, that's the worship service or the open study of the church. There are instances of private things where there are only members, such as an elders meeting or a deacons meeting or a meeting of the women that want to come together for a purpose of the church, that a non-believer would have no part in.
Yeah.
Or right to participate.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
They have not submitted to the Lord yet. But as far as you know, what we're doing now or the worship, certainly all are welcome. Just as Israel had, you know, God talked about a foreigner in their midst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had foreigners that dwelt with them. But what part would an unbeliever have in a decision being made by officers of the church or teachers maybe discussing what would be taught?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I guess you're... I never really thought of it like that. It's one of those things that the elders of the congregations make the decisions on. We're just not told anything about. I mean, the idea of business meetings... There's nothing in the Bible about business meetings. The more I think about this, maybe the only private, so to speak, meeting in Acts 14, when the apostles came together with the elders at Jerusalem and Paul and Silas to talk about what should Paul, Silas, Barnabas, can't remember who else was there, to talk about what to do with the Gentiles.
Jesus did that with the apostles all the time. He had meetings with them.
Yeah.
Sometimes he had meetings with everybody.
Yeah.
Well, now, business meeting, I wasn't really talking about business meeting. That's not an act of worship. And
no.
If an unbeliever wants to sit in on that, that's fine, but they have no right to make any type of decision.
Well, actually, it's interesting. That's the next question. It's really related to the next question that I want to address today before we quit. Tad talked about the second of the three major issues related to participation under this idea of who is the assembly and The first was on women. We talked about that. And then the last was mutual edification. And then sort of the third question that's a kind of a strange question is, can non-Christians participate in the assembly? And I think that's what you're getting at, isn't it? That can they participate? And the notes that I had on this section were really short, and that is that we don't ever see any example of a non-Christian addressing the assembly, ever. We just don't see it. We see non-Christians addressing other Christians, but it's clearly not the assembly when those things are happening. And I guess the question I was left with, why would we want that to happen?
I mean, there might be a clarification issue there. I mean, we were all non-believers at one point in time, if you want to look at it from the standpoint of before we were baptized.
Yeah.
So, you know, if a person is you might classify them as a non-believer, which might not be totally accurate. They might just be a person that's not converted yet, but maybe they're here because they want to become a believer. And they still get the benefit. We want them to have the benefit. We want them to see the way, and they have, you know, they might interact in their thoughts and in their discussion, but as far as participating in some leading or teaching role, there's no way. But
yeah.
We want them to be here. We want them to understand. We want them to be a part of us. So there is some. They may have some connection in that matter.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, if a non-believer was here and asked a question, we would actually. Those are the people we would want to ask questions for sure. So if we're defining participation in a very broad way, saying any kind of participation, whether it's a question, you're right. I guess I should maybe clarify. I think that would be acceptable. But if we were to have, say, I know of congregations. I did it myself too. Before I was baptized, we had a little song leading class of young men. And I was probably 11 or something, and I led a song. In retrospect, I mean, I was really excited. I got to lead a song. I was petrified, and I probably sang just as out of key as I do now. Probably not the right thing to do. It's probably not right to have people who are non-Christians leading the congregation in any circumstance, even in that circumstance. Okay, well, we better stop for now. We may address this a little bit next week, but for sure we're going to start on what, and that's the last major section. It's going to talk about what we do when we assemble. Okay, let's take a short break.
Yes.